So in this session, I'd like to deal with an Old Testament passage that reveals some things that are of interest. And so we'll the whole subject of the Lord's guidance in our life is obviously a huge topic. And so this sort of deals with that. And so hopefully it will stimulate you to have questions or comments on it. And it's because I think it's very important. And as we talked after lunch, that sort of summarizes a lot of things that we were talking about. So if you want to look or not look, we're going to read in Numbers 9. Numbers 9, 15. And the tent of meeting had been constructed. And then the Lord talks about the Passover that will be done. And then he goes into the next section in 15 of chapter 9. And we read this. And on that day, the tabernacle was reared up. On the day that the tabernacle was reared up, the cloud covered the tabernacle, namely the tent of testimony. And at evening, there was upon the tabernacle, as it were, the appearance of fire until the morning. So it was always. The cloud covered it by day, and the appearance of fire by night. And when the cloud was taken up from the tabernacle, then after that the children of Israel journeyed. And in the place where the cloud stayed, there the children of Israel pitched their tents. At the command of the Lord, the children of Israel journeyed, and at the command of the Lord they pitched. As long as the cloud abode on the tabernacle, they rested in their tents. And when the cloud tarried long upon the tabernacle, many days, then the children of Israel kept the charge of the Lord and did not journey. And so it was, when the cloud was a few days upon the tabernacle, according to the commandment of the Lord, they stayed in their tents, and according to the commandment of the Lord, they journeyed. And so it was, when the cloud rested from evening to morning, and that the cloud was taken up in the morning, then they journeyed. Whether it was by day or by night that the cloud was taken up, they journeyed. Or whether it were 2 days or a month or a year that the cloud tarried upon the tabernacle, remaining on it, the children of Israel stayed in their tents and journeyed not. But when it was taken up, they journeyed. At the commandment of the Lord, they rested in the tents, and at the commandment of the Lord, they journeyed. They kept the charge of the Lord at the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses. Then we read in chapter 10, the first time that this happened, actually occurred, in verse 11 of chapter 10. And it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken from off the tabernacle of the testimony, and the children of Israel took their journeys out of the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud rested in the wilderness at Paran. And they first took their journey according to the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses. So here we have in type and shadow some things to consider. First of all, you can see that the house of the Lord at that point, which of course was temporary, but at that point was finished according to the pattern that the Lord had given Moses. And then you have the instruction regarding the Passover, and then you have the instruction concerning their movement and their staying still. So to make a few comments on the, to just sort of make some parallels with us, first of all, you have the Lord giving the pattern for the house that was at that point, the dwelling place of the Lord. Obviously, we are the, as it were, the tabernacle of the Lord now. We are his dwelling place. And so the Lord establishes his house first before he talks about the guidance that he's going to give them with the cloud and the fire. And remember in Hebrews 3, it talks about us being the house of the Lord, whose house we are if we continue steadfast unto the end. So I think that's an important point that fits in with what we talked about this morning, that the Lord has come to dwell in us by the Spirit, and we have become his house. We are his dwelling place. So that comes first. So that's sort of like, you know, our starting point, that we are his people. And we can also see the parallel in terms of the Passover that is given, and how Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11 that, or is it 5? Anyway, in 1 Corinthians he says that Christ is our Passover. And so we, as his house, we feast upon him, our Lord Jesus Christ, and he is our meat and our drink. He is our Passover, of course. And he is the one, as we saw this morning, he is the one who is faithful in the Lord's house. And therefore, we are privileged to be his people and the dwelling place that he now has. So the Lord isn't dwelling in buildings or mobile units anymore. He's dwelling in us, in his people, and we are his house. We have the Passover that's been completed once and for all in Christ. And then we come to the guidance that was given to the house of Israel. Now what's significant here, as you can see, it's pretty obvious, is that what's the main point that emerges here is that the Lord gave the you might say the criteria for moving or not moving, and that was the cloud resting or the cloud lifting. So as long as the cloud was resting, then they were to stay still. But when the cloud would rise, and at night would be, as it were, a fire, they were to move. And so it indicates, of course, that there were variations, of course, that could be short, overnight, they would just be still for a short amount of time, or it could be a long time. But the point was, whether it was short or long, they didn't move until the cloud lifted. Of course, we could talk, too, about the cloud. You remember in the Transfiguration passage in Luke 9, Matthew 17, that the cloud came, and when Peter, James, and John were trying to find words and thoughts, and Moses and Elijah are talking with Jesus about his exodus that he would accomplish in Jerusalem, and the cloud comes, and that cloud, of course, represents the Shekinah glory that was in the Old Testament times, and the Lord speaks out of that cloud and says, "This is my beloved Son, hear him." And when they looked up, they saw Jesus only, and Moses and Elijah had disappeared. And so the Lord made it pretty clear in that cloud that his pleasure was in his Son, and that they were to listen to him, that he was the one that would give the direction. So here the cloud stays or lifts. Now, obviously this was fairly straightforward. In other words, you know, you can tell if the cloud is down or up, lifting. So it was very, visible, you might say. In other words, there was no guesswork. It wasn't like you could go wrong. You knew that as long as that cloud was down, you were to stay where you were. But if it lifted, you move. You follow. He guided them. So, now, of course, there was the possibility that they could move without his permission, if you will, or his will, his command. But in this case, it says they didn't do that. They followed the direction of the Lord. So I think there's something very significant here for us, which, again, sounds so easy, but it isn't. Because now we don't have a visible cloud where we can just, you know, have here's the cloud, we stay, and the cloud lifts, and we go. Because now we have a living relationship with Christ, and it's by faith. It's not by sight. So the Lord has promised to guide us, and the principle is still the same. We should not want to move unless the Lord lifts the cloud, but not in a literal sense, but in the sense of giving his benediction to our moving. Otherwise, we should stay. So we want to move or stay according to the Lord's mind. And to me, this is such a foundational matter when it comes to obviously our individual lives, but also our lives corporately with one another. Because it's one thing for me to try to move and stay according to the Lord's prompting and all. But when you add others to the mix and you have a body, then that becomes a corporate matter where we want to listen to Christ together. We want to hear his voice together. And this is where, you know, it can get tricky because, again, there's our own chemistry involved in this, our corporate chemistry involved. And, you know, sometimes we may think it's hard to hear the voice of the Lord, and other times we may think it's easy. But the point is, that's the issue. So whenever we're faced with anything, whether it be my individual life or our life together, the question should always be, is the Lord lifting the cloud for us to move? Or is the cloud staying for us to stay? Now, to put it in blunt terms, and again, I'm being overly simplistic, but you'll get the point. When we come together as a body, we're under his leadership. We want him to guide everything that happens. And in theory, we come together with no agenda, with no predetermined church bulletin or anything that tells us what's going to happen and all that. We're open to the Lord to lead us in that particular encounter with him. So to put it bluntly, we should not want to sing unless the Lord lifts the cloud for us to sing. We should not teach unless the Lord lifts the cloud for us to teach. In other words, everything we do together, we shouldn't just assume anything. Because if we do, and even, as you know, even in informal groups that have no church bulletin, you can still end up with a pattern that you go through every week, and it becomes rote. And we just assume, well, we'll start with five songs, and then we'll open, you know. In other words, you just assume, here's the way we're doing it. But we need to be careful about that, because according to what's happening here with the Israelites, there's a principle that when we come together, we should not assume anything. The issue is, what is the Lord lifting the cloud for us to do? What direction are we to move in? And that's very hard for us, because all of us have different levels of comfortableness with spontaneity and freedom. Some people like a church bulletin because it tells you everything that's going to happen, and you know it's predictable and it's not very vulnerable, and you just go through it and you're done and you go home. But when you're coming together under the Lord's hand, then you see it puts it in a different dimension. Because now we're not assuming anything except that we are here and we want him to be the king. And whatever he leads us to do, in whatever ways he lifts the cloud, that's what we want to do. What if he wanted us to be silent for 45 minutes or whatever? You know, would we be willing to submit to that? And again, that can be troublesome for at least American believers, because we're so used, as we were talking about after lunch and all, we're in such a instant and fast-moving culture, and it's hard for us to deal with silence. We have to have things always going. We want to hear sounds. We just can't. It's hard for us to rest in silence. But I think it's natural, given all the things that it says in the Psalms, for example, about, you know, be quiet and know that I am the Lord. Be still and know that I am the Lord. Silence is a beautiful thing, even corporately. And we shouldn't be afraid of that if the Lord lifts the cloud for us to be silent. But we can't assume that the Lord wants us always to talk. We can't assume he wants us always to sing. We can't assume he wants us to teach. We cannot assume anything except that we want him to guide us in this encounter, in these moments together. We want him to have his way. And I think all of us have different struggles in this area. I know I do. And then backing up a little bit into a bigger picture, I think we all struggle in some way with what Israel struggled with, and that is, it's come to the point where we think we want a king like the nations. And we'd like a visible king. And the Lord was upset with that request because they weren't satisfied with an invisible king. They weren't satisfied with a king that they couldn't see. They wanted to be like the other nations who had kings sitting on thrones and all that. And that's what they wanted, something tangible. So the Lord gave them their kings. But he said that when you get your kings, he's going to take your children. He's going to take your wealth. He's going to take everything from you. And indeed, that was true in the history. And it's the same, unfortunately, with the church that has come to want kings like Israel. They are not happy with having a King Jesus who's here right now. He's in us right now. But he's not a human being, as it were, sitting here in the room. We can't see him. We know he's here, we believe in him and all of that, but he's just not here in a physical way. We can't shake hands with him or hug him or anything. So I think we all struggle with that in different ways, because it's so easy to want something tangible, to just trust him to guide and direct and lift the cloud and put the cloud down and all that. That's tough. Because we want an answer now. We want action. We want things to happen. And it's difficult to wait on the Lord and wait for him to lift the cloud, in whatever sense that may mean. And apparently, as we read in chapter 10, it appears, if I am reading it correctly, that when the cloud appeared, that it was 2 years before they moved. The first time they moved was 2 years after this bit that we read about the finishing of the tent and the Passover and then the cloud coming. So it says that it was 2 years. Now, just think about that. With Israel, we're talking about lots of people. Some people estimate it could be 1 million people, but it's a huge number, whatever it is. And can you imagine having that many people tarry for 2 years? in the same spot. Now, it doesn't mean they couldn't move in, you know, in a certain way, but it just means that the camp did not move anywhere. They stayed in one place for over two years. And then the Lord lifted the cloud, and they left, and they went. So I think that shows us that we need patience in all this, because we believe the Lord is our leader, whom having not seen, you love. But it's hard for us to wait on him and let him lift the cloud or cause the cloud to tarry. So when the body of Christ meets under his lordship, it seems to me that we need to really wrestle with the implications of this cloud tarrying or lifting. Because, again, all of us are used to certain religious patterns that we've come out of or experienced. And those patterns tend to cling to us like barnacles, even though we've come out of Egypt, if you will. In other words, we've left something. But those religious barnacles can still hang on us, and it's very subtle. So I would encourage you to think about the implications of this for Christians gathering together, and to think about the implications of this for your own individual guidance by the Lord. But I'm thinking primarily right now of our corporate times together and our life together. And so any group over a period of time, of course, will experience the need to discuss problems that could arise, or, you know, various issues that they might want to respond to or whatever. So that implies discussion and working it out and listening to each other and hearing each other's perspectives. And so in those times of discussion and seeking his mind, I would encourage you to, again, consider this perspective of the cloud staying or leaving, and that a group should not act or move unless the cloud lifts, and unless, and in the cloud lifting, I am seeing as what you might call a consensus, where the peace of Christ descends on the group when they're discussing whatever the issue may be. And when that sweet peace comes and settles upon the group, then they know they can move. The Lord has lifted the cloud and we can move. We have some level of confidence that we are on the same page and we are ready to go forth, whatever that may mean. So it could be as something as simple as like changing the day that you meet on, you know, or it could be any number of issues, like considering discussing some sort of outreach to whatever, you know. It could be any number of things that a group will end up discussing. But whatever it is, the group should wait on the Lord until there's that peace that passes understanding. Now, as you all know, maybe better than I do, we've all seen church voting where the Robert's Rules of Order rules the roost, and the Constitution has certain, the Constitution of the Church has certain you know, ways of doing things and all that. So we've all seen cases where, like, just say, like, calling a pastor. And so you've got, maybe, let's say you've got 300 people in the church, and so they bring in candidates and they hear them preach and all that, and then they come to a time when they're going to vote on somebody. And so here we have, you know, Harry Brown, who's come and candidated here. And so you vote, and you put Harry Brown in front of the people, and they, however they vote with their, you know, ballot or whatever they do, you know, and it comes out to where it's, what did I say, 300? So let's say it's 200 to 100. So 200 people want Harry and 100 don't. Now, according to their rules of how they do things, that would be a sufficient vote to get Harry to be the pastor. So they could say, we've got a vote here where we've got enough majority, and we're going to call Harry. We're going to suggest to the church that we call Harry. So what happens in those situations with the 100 that didn't want Harry? Well, when Harry comes, then those people are probably going to be antagonistic. They're going to probably fight. If Harry has some new vision for the church or something, they're probably going to fight it. My point is simply that you know very well, you've all seen it probably, where majority voting just doesn't cut it. Because you end up with people who will leave a church. If the vote went the way they didn't like it, then they'll just leave. Is it worth it to have people just go away because of the nature of a majority vote? It just seems like that's such a worldly way of approaching things. And I know when you're talking about 300 people, the idea of coming to consensus together is very difficult. But if we look at how the New Testament church was configured, then in terms of making decisions, you're probably talking about a lot smaller group that would be more family-like, and you would be able to work through to a consensus, with a smaller number of people. And so a group of people, let's just say you had an issue with possible sin in the body where somebody was openly contradicting the gospel walk, and I'm talking about things that are clear, not gray issues, drunkenness, adultery, things like that. And so the body is faced with having to help a person in that situation. So again, that's a pretty thorny kind of thing. It's not comfortable. It's certainly not pleasant, but it does need to happen. So in those kind of situations, the body's going to have to, be careful that the basic flow of Matthew 18 is followed, where the person is approached privately and then with witnesses, and if they aren't repentant, that has to be brought to the ecclesia. And again, I don't think that's a 1-2-3 formula. You could go to a person privately 7 times before you brought witnesses. You might bring witnesses 7 times before you bring it to the body. So it's not a formula thing, but it's the spirit of it. The goal is restoration. The goal is repentance. But if the person is hardened and will not repent, then it ultimately has to come to the body. Okay, and Paul says that, the leaven leavens the whole lump. So you have to deal with it. You can't be footloose and fancy free with that kind of thing. So those are the kind of things that have to be discussed in a sober way. So again, we don't want to act hastily. We don't want to act viciously. We want to act in a way that honors Christ and is in the good of the person that's in a problem and all that. So my point is simply that, again, from an easy issue like what day we're going to meet on, to a thorny issue of sin in the body, in all those cases, your goal is for the peace of Christ to rule in the group. And Paul uses that phrase in Colossians, I believe, where he says, let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts. And of course, the word rule there is the idea of umpiring. In other words, let the peace of God be your umpire. Let it resolve the conflict. And so that's our goal. And sometimes, that's not easy because, and this is a, we'll talk maybe about this a little bit. What if you had a situation where, let's just say it's not so much a critical issue like sin in the body, but, something more like what day you meet on. What if everybody in the group is cool with meeting on Friday night, but there's one family, a husband and wife, that aren't comfortable with it, okay? So I'm just giving some basic guidelines. But in that kind of a situation, it's very important that the people who are dissenting from what appears to be the majority flow, you need to hear them out. Maybe they're seeing something that the rest of the people are missing. That is a real possibility. So you want to be sure that you give ample time for the minority view to express its concerns and all that. So maybe if they share some things that the other group, rest of the group didn't think about, then that's great. And they, thank you. We didn't even think about that. And that will help then in the decision making. But if they present their concerns, and those concerns really don't seem to have a lot of weight, but it's maybe, an emotional thing or, just something that's a preference on their part, but it's not really substantive, then in those cases, you see, once you've listened to them and they can't come up with any goods for, a solid reason why something is wrong, then often I've seen where a situation like that where they'll just assent to the rest of the group, because really to them it's not, a major deal. It's just that they had some preferences. So they'll just say, well, if the rest of you like Friday night, that's fine, and we'll go along with that. And that's good. But anyway, my point is you just have to be sensitive to all voices. Everybody in the body has to be free to express their perspective on an issue. And others should listen and process those things with the goal of hearing Jesus Christ come and give peace as an umpire to the body. And again, this is not always easy. And that's where you get into the whole thing of time. It may take time, and if it does, you need to be patient. Don't rush anything through. Most decisions are not that, critical to be immediately acted on. Maybe some are, but not the ones that are probably ones where you've got some, a flagrant problem occurring where you just can't tarry. But in most cases, you can wait on some things. So you just need to be, again, listening to the Lord and seeking Him. And I'm sure that He will give wisdom to those who lack. So the dynamics in the body of Christ, I think, are related to what we see here with the cloud lifting and rising. And that, as we discussed after lunch, we talked about what's the difference between starting a group and Jesus birthing a group. And so starting something is basically a human initiative. It's something that people are starting. People maybe of some like-mindedness, get together and say, well, let's start a group. Let's start meeting on Friday nights and all that. But Jesus Christ birthing an ecclesia is different than that, totally different, totally other. And we talked about that this afternoon. That Christ birthing something is where it's not human machinations. It's not people making something happen or manipulating things to happen. But it's the Lord bringing people together who see the Lord increasingly together, and they want to follow Him together, then you've got something that's birthed, not started. And there's a lot more to say on that, but that's all I'll say for now. So, again, we shouldn't pursue something together unless the Lord has birthed it, unless the Lord has lifted the cloud and we can move. That's the key. Now, having said all of this, I do think that it's important to say that we all know that all of us individually or together are capable of making mistakes. We're capable of misreading the Lord. We're capable of thinking the Lord was leading us, but maybe He wasn't. So that's certainly a possibility. And you can't deny that it's probably going to be a reality in the life of a body together. But here's the thing, is that making a mistake usually, again, is not critical. Like, let's say that a group felt strongly that it was great to meet on Friday night, but after doing it for 6 weeks, you know, they just sort of all realized that it stunk. Okay, so for the group to regroup and say, well, you know, 6 weeks ago we agreed on Friday and now we've experienced this and, you know, we just aren't feeling comfortable about it. What do you guys think? You know, and so you talk it over. Maybe you decide, well, maybe Sunday night. Okay, but my point is that you can always revisit things. Any decision you make is not in concrete. So, and there's nothing shameful about admitting that we could make a mistake. That's obviously part of life. We've all made mistakes in our journey. So, fortunately, the Lord, you know, helps repair our mistakes too. So, we just again need to be sensitive to the Lord and His promise that He will be with us till the end of the age, and that He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is not going to leave us or forsake us. He has promised to guide His flock. He cares for His sheep and will give them pasture. So that's our hope, not ourselves. Our hope is in the shepherd, the great shepherd of the sheep. And we know that He guides His flock. He knows them by name. He loves them with the greatest love you could ever imagine. So the promise is there. It's, again, it isn't like we have to get Him, you know, to be on our side. It's not like we have to do something to get Him to guide us or, you know, no. He's already in us. He already loves us. He already accepts us. So we're already His sheep. So the promise is there. He will guide us. What is our responsibility? Well, like James says, if you lack wisdom, ask Him, and He gives liberally to those who ask. Jesus said that those who ask for the Holy Spirit are not going to get a stone or a scorpion. So the Lord's goodness to us is manifest. And I think that's our hope and our prayer.
I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's, of course, a whole lot more that could be said, but these are the basics that I wanted to share tonight, and perhaps you have some questions or comments that you'd like to make in light of this that will give us some further perspective and whatever, yeah?
Can you give a real example of, in an organic church setting that you experienced in your life, how does the cloud, the hand mm-hmm. of the Lord guides the church in terms of when we worship together, when we encounter God together corporately? How does it happen?
Well, of course, that is a tough question. Let me give you an example that relates to the problem of sin in the body that happened in Massachusetts. This group had a situation where an older sister had actually fallen into some sin, and this person had a very close friend, another sister. Well, when the group, when it finally had to come to the church, and the church concluded that the only thing they could do was put this person out because they were not repentant. This other sister, who was close friends with her, you know, sort of protested and said, do we have to do this? Is this really the right thing to do? So instead of just, you know, putting her down and saying, come on, wake up, don't you see the light? They said, let's postpone this decision a week, and some of us will go visit the sister that had the issue. So in the middle of the week, two brothers came over to her house, and they went over the situation and explained why they felt they needed to do this. And after she heard what they said, she just said, right, this is what we need to do. But then she started crying uncontrollably. And they were a little taken back, you know, and they said, "What's up?" And she said, "I've been in churches all my life." And she said, "This is the first time that anybody cared about my opinion. And I thank you for coming over here and taking the time to explain to me why you were doing what we need to do. And I'm just thankful that you care about what I thought." So that's an example of how a church can wait and make sure that everybody's listened to and take the time to explain things to people if they don't understand it, and all that. So
John, that, the brothers went to the sister who was dissenting?
Two brothers went.
Oh, yeah, two brothers went to the sister who was dissenting.
Yeah.
Not the sister who was at fault.
Oh, no. No.
Okay.
The,
I see. Okay.
No. The sister who was at fault was hardened. I mean, she was not soft. Right.
And so finally, did this sister change her opinion?
Yeah, she said, "We've got to do this." So the next meeting, they carried that action out, and they disfellowshipped that person. Yeah. So that's an example of that. In terms of just a gathering of saints, I could give this example. This was a case where I had prepared something to bring, a short teaching that morning, and typically in that group, you know, we sang some songs and then had sort of an open time and all that. But anyway, we had a visitor, not really a sort of a visitor. No, she might come three times a year, so she was, you know, not a regular. Okay, so she shows up. So just as we were, I think we were in between songs, and she just had some tears come to her eyes, and she just said to the group, "Is it okay if I share with you something about my relationship with my physical brother?" And we knew that she had issues with her brother and sister. So anyway, we said, sure. So she shared the problem and how she had a letter, you know, and so it was nasty and all that. So we listened to her. We gave her some basic counsel and encouragement and basically told her, you know, not to return in kind and to basically not return evil for evil and all that. Well, anyway, that ended up taking probably 45 minutes. So what I had prepared was never shared, and the whole gathering was just changed. So that's an example of how, in a moment, the whole direction can change and be devoted to something that comes up in the moment, and the group responds, and there you are. So that's an example of something like that. But there, the point is that when we come together with no agenda, but wanting the Lord to lift the cloud or have the cloud stay, then that allows us the freedom to listen to Him, and listening to Him can come through the brethren. In other words, if you brought up something that concerned your heart or whatever, then we would be willing to listen to it. So anyway, there are lots of endless examples could be given on that, but I think you get the general drift.
So say if we were to make a decision, and there are 10 people, and one person is dissenting, and you know the other 9 people will listen to the known person, and if that person, whatever they are saying, doesn't make sense, but they're still dissenting,
mm-hmm.
they do not want to go along with the opinion of the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Like in such cases, like what do we do?
Yeah, that's a excellent question. I over the years I've come to the feeling that if you've listened to them fully and allowed them to share their heart, and that you make sure that they feel that they've been listened to, go ahead.
Can you explain to the driver because he got lost?
Oh, you got lost. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Sorry.
That's okay.
It's a pizza guy.
Yep. So we'll fill Sam in later. But what was the example we were talking about? The
the group, someone made.
Oh, the dissenter, one dissenter, right? So if the person has felt listened to, then if they don't have anything of substance other than feelings or, you know, just something that isn't really very substantive, then it seems to me that the group should appeal, the other nine should appeal to this person to go along with the others because they haven't provided any significant reason why they shouldn't do X. And so if that person has a sensitive, submissive heart, I would think that they would, if they can't come up with the goods, then it seems to me they should submit to what the other part of the rest of the body has come to and leave it at that. And again, a lot depends on the nature of the person who's dissenting, because obviously there are some people who get sort of feisty and cantankerous, but hopefully that in a organic church that you're not really going to have a person quite like that, because that's not a very, you know, not a very good spirit.
So you're saying that you haven't come across situations where this one person just sticks to their ground and they don't want to, you know, give in to the, or, you know, you don't see the...
Most of the examples I've seen of where people won't submit to the rest of the group would be a little bit more in the institutional vein, smaller institutional churches, not big ones, but smaller ones, where you might have 50 people, and they say, you know, most of the people agree on something, but there's maybe one family that's not agreeing. Then it seems like that one family ends up holding up the whole body because of their stink. So it's a tough, it's not an easy question, because there's always some chemistry of the group, chemistry of the individual, and all that. So the key to me is you listen to them, you make sure they feel heard, and if they don't have any substance, then it seems to me you have to appeal to them to just go along with the group. And again, if the group has made a mistake, mm-hmm. there's always the possibility of revisiting
right,
the
right.
point. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's closed, you know, forever. And and the person who's dissenting needs to understand that. You could say to them, well, it appears to us we should just go ahead and try meeting on Tuesday for a while, and if we need to, we'll come back and revisit it, you know. So most of the time in small organic churches, I mean, all I can say is I haven't seen a lot of cantankerous, feisty spirit, you know? I mean, most people are willing to listen and, you know. And if the other brothers and sisters point out to them that they're trying hard to process what they're saying, but they don't find anything of substance, then it seems to me the other person should listen to that. That perhaps Christ is speaking through the body to them, indicating that, well, yeah, I do have preferences, I have emotions, but there's nothing really here of substance. And then just to say, okay, I'll go along with you guys, and we can always revisit it. But, you know, so hopefully, now in the case of like this lady that had problems with them disfellowshipping the sister. Those are the kind that can get more sticky, because if you have a person who disagrees with the direction of the body in terms of confronting somebody about sin or whatever, that can get pretty thorny. I won't deny that, because obviously it could be like family or friends, and so when they see their friend or their relative getting confronted about an open sin, you know, sometimes that can be troublesome. I won't deny it. It's tough. But all I can say is the body should stick to their guns in a loving way and not, you know, not knuckle under, because, again, I'm talking about open sin, flagrant sin. that, you know, you just can't let that slide because it's not good for the body, and it can create some problems. I won't deny it. So that's why the group should be, again, very careful that they're listening to Christ in how to handle this, because things can get very sticky. And that's why it's important to be able to say, we've gone to this person privately multiple times. We've gone to them with several people several times. And because of the response, we have no choice but to bring it to the body. And so that can get tough, I'll tell you that, you know. But if, and of course, as you know, sometimes people are disciplined for things that aren't sin. And they're the mores of the group. They're not things that Jesus is concerned about. So, of course, that's another whole issue. So if a body is confronting somebody over a trivial cultural issue, then that's a whole different ballgame. And so the dissenter might be right in saying, you know, what are you guys doing? You're confronting this person, you know, maybe about having a cigarette or something. I mean, it's like, you know, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. So the dissenter may very well have some insight in that case. You know, when they're seeing that this is not an issue Christ is heavy about, it's ludicrous. But Christ did say, what you bind on earth is bound in heaven and all. So in other words, it is a serious matter. But you want to be sure that you're in agreement with heaven, as it were. In other words, you don't want to be again doing something from an earthly standpoint. You want to be sure that you're in line with Christ. Otherwise, you will create a very bad mess. And as you know, were you going to say something?
I'm sorry. When it comes to the kids in the middle, like, see, we just started doing the switching on and off thing. We visited another organic church, like, when we first, you know, read the books and everything like that. And they kind of did it, like, one person, they were in the same room, but one person was off to the side, and they read a story to them. Why, maybe the group went in here, and they would, like, switch off. So what do you suggest?
Well, first of all, I would say there's no one answer, and every group has to wrestle with this issue. So, obviously, the whole structure you're meeting in, I mean, you know, the rooms and all that. So, I mean, you got all these different levels of things to think about. So, all I can say is the groups I've seen over the years have handled it in just about every way conceivable. Like, there was one group in San Antonio that the person had a huge backyard, and so they basically rotated people who would watch the kids while the meeting was going on outside. And so they basically stayed outdoors. Of course, San Antonio is pretty, climate is mild. So, or obviously it can be hot, but it's not going to be freezing. But anyway, so that's one thing. I've seen people have the children be part of the meeting up to some point, and then the children are taken out. I mean, these are things that, I mean, we don't want children, my idea is that I wouldn't want children to think that all of this is just about adults. I mean, but on the other hand, kids that are real tiny who can't really profit from the discussion and all, they can be very disruptive and chaotic. So somewhere in all that, you have to figure out what are the best things for us to do to maximize our edification with one another, not put the burden on one person to watch the kids, share the burden, and then just consider how the adults can function together without having kids running all over the place, you know, as kids, not that that's sinful, but just kids are kids. So, so I have no answer. All I have is that again, the group should discuss this. Now, I remember in one group, they had an issue like this, and nobody really had an idea as to how it would resolve itself, because every option looked sort of you know, it didn't look so good. But it was amazing when the group actually came together and talked about it. It was almost like instantly a resolution appeared, because when they were started talking, they realized that there was one young lady who was probably 18 or 19, who was pretty was in the group. I mean, she was a daughter of someone in the group, and so anyway, she ended up watching the kids, and then they paid her for that time that she did that. So that, I mean, that just, you know, that resolved itself quickly, but nobody thought of her until they came together and started wrestling with it. And then within probably 15 minutes, they had an answer, and everybody was pleased with it, and they tried it out, and it worked, and so they went with it. And again, with a kid thing, that's the kind of thing you might have to revisit several times, you know, because, you know, things change, whatever. So you just have to be willing to evaluate that and seek the Lord about how edification can be maximized, and the kids can maybe be a part of it in an appropriate way. So, you know, these are all things where there's no laws. It's just a question of the Lord lifting the cloud or whatever. Mm-hmm. Some groups I've mingled with, you know, hardly have any little children. They're mostly teenagers and adults. They're grown up, so they don't face that particular problem. But most groups right now that I've rubbed shoulders with do have little children. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, in several cases, there's only one family that has little children. So it isn't like you've got multiple families with multiple children. So when you've got one family with children, that's different too. So, you know, you just have to work it out.
I have another question. So say if within the group, you know, we being all human beings and still having the flesh, somebody could hurt somebody's feeling, or, you know, there could be some, you know, rubbing the other person the wrong way, some misunderstanding or something. And if it gets to the point where it doesn't seem to get resolved among the group,
mm-hmm.
Can we, like, contact somebody like you and ask for your advice in, you know, explain to you the situation? Because a lot of times, because we are part of the group and part of the problem, I may not see, you know, the problem. I may see it only in the way that I want to see the problem.
Right.
He'll see the problem in how he wants to see it. And so therefore there will be no resolution to it.
Right.
So in such a situation, can we approach you and ask for your wisdom or, you know, your guidance?
Oh, absolutely. However, I would just say that someone like me should be a last resort,
mm-hmm.
because I would say that hopefully 9 times out of 10, if it's involving two people that are having a personality rub or something like that, hopefully if again, there's no rules here, but if you could have one person or a couple try to help mediate between the two. I mean, if the two could get together and resolve it, I mean, that would be super, but sometimes that's not so easy. But if you could have somebody come alongside to help, then I would hope that 9 times out of 10 that perhaps there could be some resolution. And if there isn't, well, then of course you can go further. But I think a lot of it is most of the times, I don't think people don't mean to hurt each other. They don't mean to be malicious. They don't mean to step on somebody's toes. But so all of us need that to be called to our attention. What you said hurt me. Well, I didn't know it hurt you. I had no intention of hurting you. But it did hurt her. So, you know, you want to be open to correction. Most of the time we bother other people. It's not because we're wanting to. It's just because of our personality or their personality or something. You know, their chemistry is always varies. But anyway, I think conversation is the important thing. Don't let those kind of things be buried, because they'll explode. if you let them fester. So as 1 Corinthians 13 says, you know, we need to keep short accounts. If I feel a coldness or a isolation from another brother or sister, that's probably a sign that I need to talk to them or something, even if I don't know what it is. We all have that feeling when there's something wrong, and the Holy Spirit's very good at prompting us to know. And again, 9 times out of 10, those feelings are not based on total fact and total maliciousness or anything. It's just that, again, we all can get peeved over things, and we can all hear something and take it personally and get upset. So that's just, as you said, we're human. So the key is that if I feel that something you said hurt me or slighted me or whatever, I should go to you, and we should be developing our relationships so that I call that preventative maintenance. I mean, the more we can develop a love and a friendship with one another, then the easier it's going to be when that bump comes and I need to go to you and talk to you. And you're not going to be defensive or threatened because you know I love you and we've worked together and, you know, all that. So, and that's why, you know, in institutional churches, a lot of this never happens because people don't know each other and they get offended, but then they don't do anything about it because, you know, everybody's lost in the cracks. But when you're in face-to-face with a smaller group, you know, you can't hide a lot of these things, and they're real. So we have to be ready to, as Paul said, if somebody has an issue with somebody, forgive, even as Christ forgave you. So in other words, we have to be quick to forgive, quick to love, quick to, you know, all those things. But it's not if, it's when. Because no family can go together for a long time without somebody getting a little hurt. And so that's the reality. That's why Paul wasn't shocked when the groups had problems. He was shocked and disappointed when they didn't deal with them. You know, when the Corinthians had immorality and they hadn't done anything, you know, the immorality didn't shock him so much as the fact that they let it slide. That's what bothered him. So, yeah, and it's tough. And you know, I've said many times to groups, I'm basically a chicken. I don't like confrontation. I don't like, getting into a fracas with anybody. I like peace. I like love and all that. But the truth of body life is that as Jesus said, if your brother sins against you and he repents, forgive him. There's the assumption that any group will have some bumps. So the issue is, what are we going to do when the bumps come? Are we going to run, or are we going to just face it in love and realize this is part of life? This isn't shocking, you know. But again, the more we can love each other daily, then I think that oils the situation so that when a bump comes, then it's not like, you know, where we go berserk. So that's the key, see, is most groups don't have deepening relationships. So when the bumps come, they tend to run. They're not ready to reconcile. They just, I don't want to face it. I don't, you know, and they just run. But so the scripture says, as you know, if you're at the altar and remember your brother has something against you, stop your worship, go be reconciled, and then come back and resume your worship. So in other words, our horizontal relationships affect our vertical situation with God. So if I'm trying to worship the Lord and I think that so-and-so has something against me, what they have against me could be right or wrong, but that's not the issue. The issue is I need to go to them. And so in theory, the two of them should meet each other on the road. They should both be coming to each other. But as you know, that usually doesn't happen that way. So, Yeah, the times I've had to confront things, I would say most of the time Dottie has to kick me in the rear because I just don't like it. But it's part of life, and you have to do it. I've gotten a little better at it, but I'd rather not have it happen, but it does. But anyway, so yeah, hope that helps your question.
Mm-hmm. Basically, try to resolve it within the group.
Right.
And it should get resolved. You know?
Yeah.
It shouldn't come to reach that point where you need, you know,
yeah,
outside person.
Yeah, it's, yes. Just like Paul said about the disputes in Corinth, you know, where people had things against each other of a legal nature or whatever, he said, you know, why would you go to the unbelieving court? You know, take care of it among yourselves. So again, it doesn't mean the whole body has to know about every jot and tittle, but it does mean that the body should be the context for trying to solve problems when people have ought against each other and stuff like that. But of course, the smaller the group, obviously it's hard to hide these things. They're usually, everybody knows, you know, if something's going on. So, which in a sense is good, but it's not easy to hide in the cracks or fall into the cracks. Yeah. Sergey, any questions or comments?
Questions? I mean, it's pretty straightforward what you're saying. It's a totally new concept. Not a totally new, but we all come
right.
from, you know, institutional
right.
churches, and just living as a close community is a new concept altogether.
Yeah. Well, plus, again, we're used to having the paid staff do the decision making. So the idea of the body,
problem solving,
right? Problem solving with the few.
Yeah.
So when you put the problems in the body, then that creates a wonderful situation. But it's also it requires more prayer and labor and long suffering with each other to listen to the Lord and hear His voice. Did you have any questions, Philip?
Not right now.
Okay.
Not right now. Let me think about that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm more, you know, I'm very interested in when the church or any church as a family gathers together to worship the Lord and encounter the Lord. I know that each service or their gathering is not like any other.
Right.
Or shouldn't be.
Yep. Each one is unique.
Right. How does it happen? What in your? Can you describe the best meeting that you went to, for example? What would happen? How the Lord would manifest Himself? How the people would be moved by the Lord? What would? I don't know. It's something that happens between the Lord and His people in such type of gathering that is different from the institutional setup,
right.
The pews and, you
mm-hmm.
know, and
yeah, that's. I'm glad you asked that because there is one gathering that stands out in my heart, and it illustrates the cloud lifting and staying very much. But it was in Washington State in 1982, and this particular group had 50 people, and they were outside the institutional church, and they had home meetings during the week, and then on Sunday they met in this abandoned school building. So this was the big meeting on Sunday that we happened to come to. So without going into all the details, everything went wrong that morning from a human standpoint. It was a cold, foggy day, probably like, you know, 55 degrees or so, and it was foggy and damp. And okay, so people are starting to accumulate outside this building. Well, Nobody has a key except the janitor, who has to come and open the thing for them every week. He's not there. Okay, so people start making phone calls and trying to find this guy and all that. So people are piling up and people are getting a little antsy, you know, and all. And so finally the guy shows up. So he opens the door and everybody goes in. Well, then something else went wrong. The room where they had to set up in a gym where they meet. So the chairs and everything were in this room. Well, nobody had a key to that room. So that more issue. So I don't remember how the key got found on that one. But anyway, they got that open probably after 20 minutes. So then everybody's rushing to get the chairs out, you know, get everything going, and they're putting it. The way they put the chairs was in basically a big circle. So they had an outer one and they just went in. And then, okay, so everybody's pretty frazzled, you know. I think they were supposed to start at 10, and it had to be 10:45 to 10:50 before we actually started. So everybody's pretty frazzled. And Dottie and I, of course, are visiting, and something terrible happened that week. A sister in the church was pregnant, and a Vietnamese person could not read English very well and ran a stop sign and ran into this woman and killed the woman and the child. So here's this husband. That happened on like a Tuesday. And here it is Sunday. And he's there at the meeting. Now, of course, Dottie and I didn't know a whole lot about this, but we just heard, you know, that this happened. So anyway, they sang some songs. And they had a songbook similar to this. I mean, it was something they compiled themselves. And so we sang a few songs, and then the brother that had the tragedy stood up in front of everyone, and he said, "I want to thank you all for your prayers and your concern." And he says, "I do have one thing to say to you, however, and that is, when you call somebody who's in a situation like I am, don't say, 'How are things going?'" And when he said that, can you imagine a person saying that to 50 people? That shows that there was some level of relationship there, because you would normally not be able to say that kind of thing to a group like that. I mean, many people would be offended, you know, if you said that. But he felt comfortable saying it. And the people received it. And a lot of people probably felt terrible, you know, because that's what they said. How are things going? Well, anyway, so he said that. Well, then he just went into the Lord's goodness and how the Lord was sustaining him. And, I mean, it was just beautiful. And he said some things reflected out of Job and things like that. It was just a beautiful statement. And everybody in the room was crying. And so then after he finished and sat down, then one of the elders stood up and gave a little talk out of they had actually published a little booklet on church life. And so he was sort of going through it chapter by chapter. So he gave a little talk on a chapter. And he mentioned that Dottie and I were there and you know, thank the Lord for us and that kind of thing. And all that, and then they had some more when things went on. But then they had the Lord's Supper together. Now they didn't have it in a, you know, a meal, but the way it was done was still very very wonderful. Anyway, but we had to leave. In other words, we couldn't stay till the end because the people we were staying with had an appointment, and so we had to leave just maybe 20 minutes before the whole thing was over. Well, anyway. So anyway, the communion was just beautiful because they passed out the bread and the wine, and then people started standing up and just testifying of the Lord and his goodness and things like that. And that was just beautiful. That must have gone on for close to 15 minutes. Well, anyway, so then we had to leave. Well, when I got in, the guy had a Volkswagen bus. And when I got in the front seat and sat down, it was like I was numb, you know? And I realized, wow, what a meeting. And it was like, I just never had that. You know, I'd been a Christian since 65, and that was the first, this is 82, and this is, you know, this is the first time I really felt like the Lord was present. It was spontaneous. It was not planned, as it were. And everything went wrong. That's what really made it so strange, is everything went wrong, humanly speaking. Well, anyway, that meeting was just incredible. And I think the fact that everything went wrong at the beginning, you know, shows you that, again, you need to be open to the Lord and what He has, and not think, oh, gee, everything's ruined because we don't have chairs or whatever. So that's what sticks out of my memory as one memorable thing. So, but the meetings that have meant the most to me are the ones where unexpected things happen, where the, even if you're have an open meeting, you still sort of know, you know, the general way it's going to go. But so the meetings that have been most beautiful to me are the ones where things went a totally unexpected direction and the Lord came, you know, and that kind of thing. That's what strikes me. So again, it's just the idea of being open, not assuming things, and
being sensitive.
Right, and being sensitive to the Spirit, and follow letting Him lead. And, yep.
That 1982, that's when I was born.
Look at that. Mm-hmm. Yep.
John, can I ask you another question?
Sure.
It's not changing a topic. It's just, you know, like, you come from a another Bob Jones type of environment.
Uh-huh.
From gifts, you know, charismatic type environment. And, my wife and I went to the Coastal Church for a while. Well, started as Baptist and became, you know, moved toward Pentecostal and charismatic environment before we realized that it's...
Right.
It's a dead end.
Right.
But what about the gifts of the Spirit? And what I mean by that is probably more of the institutional, again, the Pentecostal way of people prophesying, you know, speaking in tongues or laying hands on each other or casting out demons or doing that type of ministry. Have you encountered that in an organic church environment, or is it more of a outside of the gathering?
I would say both, I don't know if you guys have read that one thing that Frank wrote, where they had the group a long time ago that he was in, where there was some charismatics and some other folks that believed the gifts had ceased, and they were in the same body, and at first it was really polarizing and all, and so they decided, obviously they were either going to split, but they didn't really like that option. So they decided that they would put the gifts on the shelf, as it were, and not make a fuss about it either way. And what happened, as Frank tells the story, is that a third thing occurred where once they made Christ the center point and pursued Him, then the gifts were manifested, but in a totally different way than the traditional that you just described and institutional view of gifts. It was just something different. And I don't know the details of that, but I have a hunch I know what he means. But anyway, I would say that that once we're, again, like we said this morning, once we're liberated by being in Christ and His faithfulness, and we can't be manipulated religiously, then that seems to be an atmosphere where the Holy Spirit can act authentically. Now, what that means, I'm not going to say, but the point is there's an openness, and not for weirdness or emotionalism or somebody's ego, but for the Spirit to really work in people. So as Paul says, each of you has a whatever. So once people can increasingly come into that, it seems to me that that opens the door for a proper manifestation of the Spirit. And again, letting the Lord lift the cloud or have the cloud stay. In other words, it just seems like that's the key, because obviously, in the charismatic circles, they have a marked tendency to make things happen, and that's just flesh. But on the other hand, you have people that are afraid of the Spirit. Frank called that pneumophobia, and so both extremes. So in the middle, there seems to be the right place to be. That we're wide open, not for craziness, but for whatever the Lord wants to bring. So I think we would possibly see more prayer for healing or different things. I personally, I'm not going to, again, make a rule, but generally groups like yours, I don't think casting out demons is usually appropriate, because I don't think that that's really, you know, the domain there. But certainly there could be cases where a visitor could come in where something like that could be necessary. I wouldn't deny that. But anyway, you get what I'm saying. It's just, again, sensitivity to all the angles and being open and testing the spirits, whether they're of God. And, you know, so I'm not afraid of anything anymore. I've seen some a pretty wide gamut of things happen. But I and I mean authentically, not manufactured. And so there's nothing to be afraid of. And I think, again, once we have that freedom of atmosphere of charged with love and Christ, then I think that's the kind of context where some surprising, wonderful, unexpected things can happen. Yeah. We had a case where a brother had a hunting accident where he was with another person and in the deer stand, and his friend fired the gun and it popped his eardrum and started bleeding. So it was pretty serious, and so he went to the doctor and all that. Well, so that was on like Friday or Saturday. So on Sunday, this person asked us to pray for him. And so we just gathered around him and prayed. Probably three or four of us were actually touching him. And then on Monday, he went to the doctor, and the doctor looked in his one ear and then the other, you know, and he looked at him and said, "Which ear was the accident in?" And he said, "This one." And he looked in again. He said, "There's nothing there. It's healed." You know, and so the brother just testified to him and said, "Well, they prayed for me this Sunday, and I didn't know what happened really, and so that happened." So I do think that I've come to the I come out of a tradition that was anti-gift, but I have come to the feeling that I really think we need to do more prayer for healing. I think that that's something that we don't take, at least most things I see, don't take that seriously enough. But again, a lot of people are scared of weirdness and they've seen extremes, but to put it in the context of the body, and it does say in James, you know, if any of you is sick, let him call for the elders, etc. But the point is, it's the person with the problem calling for people. It's not a healing meeting, you know. And so once you put so many things in the context of an organic expression, it seems like they fall into place better. Like the woman issue. If the issue is, can a woman speak behind a pulpit? You know, well, I question whether men should speak behind a pulpit. But once you put it in an informal setting where we're brothers and sisters, then the woman issue takes on a whole new dimension. So likewise with healing, once you put that in a body dimension, it begins to make more sense, because we're not faith healers who are trying to make a show. We're not putting up a tent. We're not making a big deal about it. We're just following the Lord. Again, the Lord lifts the cloud and says, pray for me. I need some healing. And the body comes around, prays, and who knows what will happen. But anyway, it just seems like the once you have an organic expression, so many of the pieces of the puzzle seem to take on a new perspective, which are not traditional, but more authentic and real. And I believe we have reason to believe the Lord will bless a loving, caring atmosphere where people are thinking of others ahead of themselves. And I think it's beautiful. And we grow in that, obviously, as time goes on. So I don't have answers like about tongues. I mean, I have no problem with it. But again, I wonder, there's so much emphasis on it in certain circles, as you know better than I, that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 14, it's pretty clear, he says tongues are a sign not to believers, but to unbelievers. And mainly tongues were a sign to Israel in the context of the first century, when it says from Isaiah, I will speak to them in other tongues. So I don't have any trouble with tongues, but I do wonder about how useful they are in all situations. It seems like maybe in a situation where folks are going to another country or something, where the Lord might give them the ability to speak in a language they'd never studied, or something, you know. I'm not going to limit God, but for any of you to just say, well, we're not authentic because nobody's speaking in tongues, you know, I would question that. I don't know that not having tongues shows anything. You know, I'm not that concerned about it. And obviously,
tongues are in two. One is other language, or it's in two different types, right?
Mm-hmm.
One is the known language in the earth. The other one is the other tongue, right? So, suppose I don't know English and you are talking in English. If I have the gift of the other tongue, I can understand what you are talking.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, that could happen. That's one option. Yeah.
Yeah.
In other words, on the day of Pentecost, when the men, 120 men and women, spoke in languages that all these people from all the nations heard the wonderful works of God in their own tongue, then there's where you have that fulfillment. I will speak to Israel in other languages right there on the day of Pentecost. But anyway, the point is they were hearing their own language in the tongue, and they were able to understand it. What you were just saying would be the reverse, where you don't know English, but when I talk in English, you understand what I'm saying. So that certainly can happen too. That's just as much an option.
Mm-hmm. We have hot pizza.
We have what?
Hot pizza.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's still hot.
Did you have any more questions?
It's kind of out of the subject, but when I talk to like my friends and stuff, about like if they're, because a lot of my friends are kind of closed off to the organized structured church because they can't, they just have no depth and they want that depth because they're going through so much of my life. Like I have this one girl, one friend who I just met and she goes to the traditional church but she's going through a divorce. Her husband's been cheating on her. I mean, it's like a soap opera. And she was just telling me her heart about how that she just, she doesn't like this anymore because it's a high buy, you know, see you next Sunday kind of thing. And everything is structured and she's getting sick of it.
Jim, you're a hero.
I told her about what
you survived.
We were out.
You survived
and
an hour?
She just.
I survived an hour and 45 minutes.
But when I tell her, when I tell people, especially about it, I'm tired.